We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
We did our formal introduction of Rabbi Adlerstein last night, but I'll briefly reintroduce him, but I'll start with the important part. He wants to know what he can call me, because as we were arranging, well, all kinds of people call me all kinds of things, but he meant that we're actually our almost cousins. My first cousin's first cousin. So, we have never met, but he figures we're part of the family. So when we spoke on Jewish unity last night, so when he quoted my uncle, I'm sure those who are here, he knows. Anyway, it's a pleasure to have him from California. I'm sure many of you have read his, he writes, I think, almost in every Jewish Action. Almost many of the Jewish Actions. He is a prolific author. He's one of the writers in the Cross Currents, you know, blog, which is a sort of a very, very popular blog. He's director of Interfaith Affairs at the Simon Wiesenthal Center in L.A. He's a professor, a teacher, a scholar, and it's a pleasure to have him to speak. He'll be speaking on halakha and sharia and Jewish and Islamic law. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Jay didn't mention I'm also a rabbi, which means that I can't break tradition. Rabbis always begin with an anecdote. And you guys have it coming ever since you were next Buffalo. At least that's what the folks who follow the NFL told me. So you're going to have to hear an anecdote from the annals of the American West. It seems there was this wagon train that made its way from the East Coast to the West Coast to find a new life. And, you know, like 100 intrepid souls and provisions. And something went drastically wrong. Along the way, they lost their bearings. And they got, as they say in Latin, verblundered. And they started running out of food and provisions, and eventually running out of water. Things looked very, very desperate. And they were all in mortal peril. They were about to die. And at this point, they looked for a volunteer, and they found one guy on the last good horse to scout around to see if they could find water to this embattled wagon train. And the fellow rode off, and to his surprise, he finds, after about 45 minutes, this little old Jew sitting under a tree. And he says, "Partner, you got to help us. We got all these people, they're going to die. We're out of water. Can you help us? Can you tell us where we can find water?" So he says, no, I'll speak English so well. Pulls out his little Yiddish-English dictionary, starts leafing through the pages. And he says, sort of in translation, he says, "The good news is that there's water ahead. You see, just over that bluff over there, there's plentiful water. But, you have to be very careful. Don't go straight over the bluff. On the other side is a bacon tree. A bacon tree. Go all the way around. Take a little longer, but much safer. Watch out for the bacon tree." So the guy rides back to the wagon train. He says, "We're saved. There's water ahead. I found this little old Jewish guy, and he told us where there's water. But he said, there's a short way, a long way. We should take the long way, not the short way. Something about a bacon tree. I think it's this Jewish thing with dietary laws." So they go straight over the bluff. At the top, they are met by 300 Indians who wipe them all out. The only guy who survives is that scout, who goes crawling back to this little old Jew. And he says, "What have you done to us? What have you done to us? They were all killed out. why did you send us there? We were met up with 300 Indians. And the guy says, oy vey, did I say bacon tree? I meant ambush. The moral of the story is that there are things that lose in translation. Now I get serious. If I were the world's greatest expert, non-Muslim expert in Sharia, there would be something wrong with me standing before you and telling you about Sharia or Islamic law. We understand better than most that there's some things that can be understood only from the inside. And I'm not the greatest expert in Islamic law. I'm not a casual reader either. I'm someplace in between. But I don't represent myself as expert. I teach Jewish law at Loyola Law School. Because of that, I've had to develop a working knowledge of other comparative law systems. I do have a good number of Islamic friends, the moderate kind, who are expert in Islamic law. But I cannot tell you that I have anything near the expertise that perhaps you should deserve. If you think that I'm coming here to trash Islamic law, then please find another session. It would be presumptuous, it would be wrong, and it's not my intention. I intend instead to fill you in on a few background details about Islamic law, and then to make some comparisons with aspects of Islamic law that are true at certain points in history, not true at other points in history, may be true, are true, of Islamic law today. I can cite chapter and verse, and the one question I will want to consider is why Jewish law and Islamic law wound up in such very, very different places, despite what they have in common. Don't even try to guess what the answer is. I'm hoping by the time we finish, some of you will still be awake. Others may have had a good shluf, but of those who are still awake, will walk away with an increased appreciation of halacha when seen in sharp contrast with another legal system. Now, I have to give you just one bit of background that has nothing to do with either Jewish law or Islamic law. And it's to make a point about two poles in any legal system, any religious legal system, perhaps any legal system, but certainly any religious legal system. Say all the monotheistic religions look at what we call Chumash, the Old Testament, as a sacred text. What they do with that sacred text is very, very different. I would argue that in religious law systems, there are two poles. One pole is of extreme rigidity, where everything is married to a word of text. And at the other end, you have almost chaotic license, where almost anything goes. And if you think for a half a second, you will recognize within the Christian world both of these poles. The first of them, of looking to the text, of a tradition-bound system where things have to come ultimately, or at least at one point in history did, from the text, is the early church, Catholicism, early Catholicism. And the break of Martin Luther and the Protestants was one that shifted the Christian look at Scripture totally in the other direction, where, as Luther said, solo scriptura. We don't need a pope. We don't need tradition. We don't need interpreters. Every person will be spoken to individually by the text. You want to know what God says, what God wants for you? Open the text and God will speak to you. You understand, I hope you understand, that Catholics really have law and Protestants generally do not because of this. Because there can't be a way of standardizing the message when everybody gets their own message. And we have somebody in California who, I don't know how many of you are expatriates from the States, but in the civil rights movement, which may have come to an end with the election of a black president, whatever you believe about the future of Barack Obama's presidency, it was one of the most beautiful moments in American history, just for that achievement. But it wasn't so long ago that there was somebody on a civil rights march by the name of Medgar Evers, back in the 1960s, who was cut down by, I think it was Klansmen. They tried apprehending his murderer, and they found the guy, or at least they thought they found the guy. They tried him, and an old white jury acquitted him. They tried him again, years later, acquitted him again. They finally got him over 20 years later on a federal civil rights charge. His wife still lives in California, where she's active in politics. The guy they got was a Protestant minister, and they finally convicted him. And he admitted that the reason why he killed Medgar Evers is because God told him so. Now, he was not insane. He wasn't one of these guys who heard voices. Scripture, and God through Scripture, told him that his life's mission was to kill as many black people and Jews as possible. So he was just responding to that message. So that'll give you just an inkling, I doubt if you need it, to just what kind of messages you can get when you think God speaks to you through Scripture without any other kind of protocol shaping what conclusions you're supposed to come up with. Just take the thought, folks, and hold it. You're going to need it by the end of the presentation. Now let's get back to Islam. We're going to start off talking about the relationship between Islam and Judaism. We're going to talk about developments in Islam. We're going to read to you some actual piskei halakha, some actual legal decisions that have come from recent courts, particularly Saudi Arabia, and then ask the question of where, how, and why we diverge so much. So what's the relationship between early Islam and the Jews? Well, just to review, all of you know this, there were a lot of Jews around in Muhammad's world. As a matter of fact, if you've been as mystified as many other people by the clear differentiation in the Quran between negative things about the Jews, which are plenty, and positive things about the Jews, which, by the way, are also plenty. There are scholars who believe that the difference is he was in Mecca, he was in Medina. One set of Jews he liked, and the others he didn't. It was Ashkenaz, Sephard, whatever. He was treated to different kinds of Jews. One of the regnant theories is that he liked Jews who were religious, and he had no tolerance for Jews, particularly Sabbath observers, who come under special scrutiny in the Quran. Read it. It's there. That Muhammad felt that what he was doing, this is a liberal interpretation, but what Muhammad felt what he was doing was similar to what the early Christians thought they were doing. They were taking a watered down or a changed Judaism, Judaism without 613 mitzvos, and sharing it with the rest of the world. And Muhammad himself at one point in his history may have recognized that this was the Judaism to the Gentile, but Jews themselves didn't need it. But his big disappointment was when he encountered Jews who neither practiced their own Judaism nor were ready to sign on with his innovation. So that disturbed him, and that's when he turned against the Jews. That was between Mecca and Medina. Now think of some of the following. I'm not going to prove the case, but some of the key words in Islam. Quran. There are those, I'm not going to tell you whether I can believe it or not, but there are those who see a similarity between the word Quran and Mikra. that the word itself may have been borrowed. Surah, the divisions within the Quran, is similar to the word sidra. The word for the teachings, for the way, the tradition of early Islam is sunnah, which sounds like and may be related to Mishnah. If that sounds too up in the air, the following will not. There are midrashim, that you and I know, that are incorporated wholly in the Quran, or at least alluded to. I will call your attention to three of them. One, two of them have to do with Adam HaRishon, with Adam. The depiction in the Midrash of Adam, of the first person created by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is of a very definite type. He was the perfect human being. He had complete intelligence. After all, he was fashioned by the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly. So he was a cut above everybody else. There is a direct reference in the Quran to the wisdom of Adam, something you're not going to find in Parshas Bereishis, not in the text itself. Furthermore, you know from the Midrash about the debate in heaven about the creation of man. What happened when HaKadosh Baruch Hu announced up in Yeshiva Shel Ma'alah that he wanted to create man? You had the debate between God and the angels. That debate is in the Quran. Finally, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu offered us the Torah, right? Where did he offer it to us? Right. The other version in the Medrash is it was in Chicago. Why Chicago? Chicago used to have a saying of, I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. Right? What was the offer we couldn't refuse? Lifted up the mountain and held it over our heads. Im tekablu mutov, im lav sham tehek farasa. Right? If you take it, fine, and if not, we will bury you too, as Nikita Khrushchev once said. And that was the deal. That is in the Quran. A reference to God picking up the mountain and the Jews standing under the mountain. Why was there so much carryover? Because, as at least we can conjecture, that the vast majority of literate people in Muhammad's environment were Jewish. He had huge contact, not just peripheral, a casual contact, huge contact with Jewish communities, with Jewish practice. Again, another piece of conjecture. Why do Muslims pray 5 times a day? One answer given by some, it's a controversial figure, Abraham Katz. He was a law professor on the East Coast. He wrote a book on Judaism in Islam. I know Muslims who hate it, and I know Muslims who love it. I can't do better than that. But Katz writes that the reason why Muslims daven 3 times a day is because, what is the maximum number of times we daven on any day? 5, Yom Kippur. And not wanting to be outdone by the Jews, they standardize the maximum number of Jewish prayers as the prayer service on every day. By the way, there are some things I believe we should be learning from them. They have a wonderful, wonderful custom that in the mosque, they have no chairs. Because they have no chairs, everybody stands. Because everybody stands, there's a time limit on the drasha of the imam. He just can't really go very long. I'm all in favor of that. Now, there are times that the influence grew more subtle. I'm sure most of you know about the incredible meteoric rise of Islamic banking just in the last 5 years or so. Billions of dollars, they say, are added to the system every day. Because Muslims don't take or give interest, they've had to come up with a whole bunch of bank products to accommodate an explosively valuable market. The issue of interest, of riba, was considered by Muslims in the early history of Islamic jurisprudence. In the early centuries, three theories grew about what was wrong with taking interest. One theory was that it was profit without labor. Bad thing. You shouldn't take money when there's no labor involved. Any medieval historians here who can point out the parallel to another thinker? Aquinas. That was the view of the early church as well. Because of that, the early church was against all forms of commerce and merchant activity. How do you take money when you didn't do anything just by acting as a middleman? So that was one Islamic theory of interest. Another one turned the prohibition against interest into one of usury, as it is in Western societies today. It's not the taking of interest, but an exorbitant rate of interest. And then there was a third theory. The third theory was that there's something wrong with assuring oneself of all the profit without taking any risk. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Right? It's like the first daf in Ezer Neshech. Kol agar natar usser. Whenever you guarantee or come close to guaranteeing a profit and take no risk, that is the definition of ribit to us and one definition of riba to them. What's the difference? The difference is, if it's the third definition is the one that is the correct one, you could do something like write a heter iska, just like we have, of turning a deposit or a loan into a bona fide investment. The difference between an investment and a loan is that in an investment, you do assume some of the risk. In the early stages of Islam, the early centuries, this was debated for a while, and then it disappeared from history. It's been resurrected. Arab oil money can do a lot of things. But back then, and for hundreds of years, it disappeared. Why? It sounded too Jewish. They had this love-hate relationship with Judaism. They took, but they wanted to show they were different, wanted to show they were better. When they grew to despise us, they tried to distance themselves. Part of what they distanced themselves from at one point in history is crucial to our argument. Now, please read my lips. This, what I'm about to tell you, is not true of all times in Islamic legal history. There were times, large times, in which there was vigorous debate back and forth, things lahavdil resembling, it is lahavdil, but still did resemble what we do in a Beit Midrash. There was vigorous trading of opinion and analysis and rules and protocols. There was even a time in Islamic law in which the jurist really made law by looking at a basic group of core principles and trying to figure out what God would want us to do simply by using our brains. This was called ijtihad, and it had its period in Islamic legal history. It may be the hope of the West that Muslims will be encouraged to return to those days, not to come up with a reform Islam, because they're too frum for that, but to rediscover some of their roots and to see what has been there in their past. However, there were already in the Quran elements that pushed away, that were ammunition for the pushback against a Jewish
over-intellectualizing of commandments, of mitzvot. I want to read to you a paraphrase to you, four lines from the second surah of the Quran. Let's see if you recognize what it's about. You can jump out of your seat or raise your hand when you get it. And when Musa said to his people, who's Musa?
Moshe.
Musa said to his people, surely Allah commands you that you should sacrifice a cow. Okay, Moshe comes to the people one day and says, guys, I want you to sacrifice a cow. Okay, so how do the people react? They say, Musa, are you joking with us? That's the way you give a mitzvah? A cow? Be real. They said, listen, ask him again. Call on your Lord and tell us what he meant. What kind of cow? So Moshe says, okay, listen. What's the problem? I want a cow. Not too old, not too young, middle age, someplace in between. So now go ahead, guys, and do it. Next verse. Moshe, you can do better than that. Go back to God and ask him what color it should be. Can't just tell us a cow. There are all kinds of cows out there. What color? So Musa says, red cow. Okay? Red cow. You'll find in some translations it says yellow, but I've never seen a yellow cow. I think the guy who translated it must have been like high on hashish. But there are other translations, I think, that do render it as red. This was introduced to me by an Islamic law professor. It was the red heifer. That's what it's called. The red heifer. So find a really red cow, one that gives delight to its beholders. So Musa says, look, find a cow that has never plowed before, has never irrigated the field, has no blemish in her. And they said, okay, now you're talking. What's the moral of the story? What is this about? What is this battle between Musa and the people? This was taken as a dig at the Jews. And the idea that the Jews have taken God's commandment and just analyzed it and just pored over it and over-intellectualized it. And that they were going to push back from. And it took a few hundred years before the feeling that the imposition of legal rigor, of spelling out the detail, of the nitty-gritty of what we know and love to be halachic detail, became a counter-reaction to ijtihad, and someplace between the 10th and 12th century, it's a good couple hundred years after Muhammad, between the 10th and the 12th century, ijtihad essentially died, except for people who every now and then would make completely new legislation. But as a way of understanding the old or how to apply the old, it died. Now, it happened to come at a time period where there were people who were also pushing back at over-intellectualization in philosophical areas. It was a reaction to the flowering of Islamic philosophy. And I can't tell you whether this is related or not. I have my guess. But from the time that these things happened, that Islamic philosophy was sort of suppressed, ijtihad died, it also, exactly the same time, was the time that Muslims ceased to be interested in science, in architecture, in mathematics, and basically pulled back from their contribution to what we know and love as the Western world. A half a minute or so on just reviewing the sources of Islamic law, and then I'm going to read you some examples. Good idea. Okay, essentially, there are three words you have to keep in mind. The Quran, you already know. That's a text. Right? Text revealed by God to Muhammad, not revealed at one time, revealed in many different sessions, eventually compiled. There is something called the Sunnah. The Sunnah are the traditions. It's essentially stories of the behavior of Muhammad and his family. That became also a large source of Islamic law, and something sort of related to it, but really different, are the hadith, and those are sayings. Not anecdotes, not stories, not observed behavior, but particular epigrams or recorded conversations of Muhammad and his companions, which also have authority if they are deemed to be reliable. How do you figure out if they're reliable? We'll leave that to them. They had all kinds of methods at different times in history. Sometimes it was by the length of the transmission, sometimes by the number of people of earlier authorities who accepted it, while others rejected it. But the stories and the sayings, even in a non-legal manner, became the basis of much, really the lion's share of Islamic law. I'm going to go through a couple of examples, please, for the third time. I am not giving you these examples to prove the superiority of halakha, although as a firm Jew I certainly believe that, but that's not my intention here, to prove by making fun of another system. That is, again, if you walked in late, that's not my intention, that's not what I will do in the conclusion. I want to just contrast what some developments in Islamic law and why they can't happen in our neck of the woods. I am also going to ask your forgiveness. Some of these examples are not G-rated. They are decidedly not G-rated. Hamevin Yavin. They're nothing I could teach in Beis Yaakov. The first one is relatively tame. There's a tradition in the hadith about Abu Bakr, who was one of the companions. Abu Bakr al-Sadiq was leading the prayer service during Muhammad's final illness. So in our terms, he was standing in front of the minyan davening at the Omid. Okay? What happens? Muhammad unexpectedly walks in through the back. I didn't expect him to be walking in. He was supposed to be sick at home. He walks in. So Muhammad walks in. You expect that you're going to yield the Umid to Muhammad. Right? That's what you're supposed to do. But Abu Bakr is standing there shuckling at the Umid, and they don't quite know how to tell him, hey, listen, look who's walked in. So the people try to signal to him to yield. They were clapping. They didn't want to yell out. They started clapping. And when they finished, Muhammad told the tzibur that this was wrong. That if they have to interrupt and tell something to the shliach tzibur in the middle of davening, rather than clap, what they should have done is recited the tasbih, which is a supplication calling out in the name of Allah, and the women should clap. The men should recite the tasbih, and the women should clap. Okay. So what do we learn from that? Women were there. Women certainly have some difference in something. Ooh, there we go. Kol Isha. There we go. I'll tell you what the Beis Din HaGadol of Saudi Arabia came up with a couple of years ago. I will give you the Mara Mokom if you want it. That's one of those I carry around. It's here. It's actually in a book right over there. The Permanent Council for Scientific Research and Legal Opinions
which is the Bezdin HaGadol, proves from here, Kol Isha is Avra. Same phrase borrowed from us, Kol B'Isha Erva. But more than that, Muslims in general should not clap. Why? Why shouldn't Muslims clap? Tzchukas HaGoyim. It's like the other guys do that. Muslims don't do that. That's something that the kuffar do. The kuffar do. You know, the Gentiles. The dinis, the pagans, they clap. Muslims shouldn't clap. If it's something that is not nice for Muslims to do because it's derech hagoyim, why can women do it? It's only women. That's the psak. The men have to be held to a higher standard. Women, it's not a problem. But women couldn't do the same as the men because they shouldn't be calling out in public. Their voices should not be heard. Now, this should get you nervous. It should get you nervous for a variety of reasons. We'll start off only with one. Do we have a halacha of kol isha erva? We sure do. So is it the same? No, it's not. Why is it not? That's what I want you to start thinking about. But before you think about that, I want to ask you what would happen if this were a ma'aseh, something that we observed 200 years ago in the Chassam Sofer's Beis Medrash, or 1,000 years ago in somebody else's Beis Medrash. What conclusion would we have come to just from this statement? An Adam Gadol walks in the back, says, you know, you shouldn't clap to interrupt, you should say a pasuk and tehillim. What are some of the possibilities? What else? You can come up with a dozen. Why should you clap when you can say Yishmach Kadosh Baruch Hu? You see any proof in this that clapping is forbidden? I hope you realize that what you're looking at is a slice of life. I'm going to give you some more of a rule that we have in our system of jurisprudence that goes Ein Lemeidin Min Hamaasa, that an anecdote, an activity per se, absent rigorous legal analysis that invalidates every counter proposal, cannot become law. If you look at any incident, there are always multiple ways of explaining it. I mean, what would happen if we had the similar thing? In our tradition, if this was recorded, that Muhammad was a frumyid and he walked into a shul and he said, you know, that's not the right thing. I think, in my neck of the woods, we would have concluded that Muhammad was a litvak. He walked into a Karlebach davening. And he said, come on, guys, you know, grow up. This is not the way we do things. Many years ago, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal, the Posek Hador in the last half of the 20th century, was sitting at a bris, a Sudas bris, one morning. And he stayed for, you know, it was after the bris, he stayed for the Suda. And he had a cup of coffee. He was looking for some milk. And he picked up a container. He looked at it. It was golden flow. He put it down, reached for another container, J&J. Took that container, poured it into his cup. What do we conclude from this? They were both called Esau. They were both called Esau. What do you conclude? Who asked you? It wasn't empty. It wasn't empty, but at least you're on the right track. What do you think happened with this? What do you think that the Muslims in the audience did? The rumors spread. Only J&J is kosher. Rav Moshe has a problem with golden flow. The word spread through the community. Next week, Rav Moshe's at another bris. There are two containers of milk in front of him. He reaches for the golden flow and pours that into his coffee. Somebody said, my high, what's going on? Why did you take, last week you were mocked, but you insisted on taking the J&J, now it's the golden flow. Rav Moshe said, what's your problem? I picked up the golden flow. It was a closed container. Why should I open a closed container if I saw another one there that was already started? Again, what's the moral of the story? When you look at an anecdote, there are multiple ways of explaining the evidence. And until you have people debating or analyzing what those are, you cannot come to a firm legal conclusion. My favorite story of this genre, I wasn't there, I can't swear it's true, but the story has legs, that one year in Bnei Brak on an Erev Pesach, a very, very chashuv, very, very important kollel younger man was seen running through the streets of Bnei Brak with a toilet strapped to his back. People are trying to figure out, like, why? And this is a Tam HaChacham that you can learn from. He doesn't do things without a cheshbon. Why is he? It must be that he figured out that toilets need hechsher. You have to kasha toilets. The Pesach, it's a nuchumra. We got to kasha toilets. And the word spread through Bnei Brak, you got to kasha your toilet. Finally, somebody thought of asking the guy. Was he a guy who just was into the chumra mode?
Yeah, he was taking it to the plumber.
Exactly. He said it was Erev Pesach. The toilet broke. I couldn't find his Bnei Brak. Every plumber's from. Who's going to come and fix my toilet? I finally found one guy who said, if I bring it to him, he'll fix it. So he was an enterprising guy. He figured out how to get the toilet up, and he took it to the plumber. Right. But that didn't stop. That didn't stop a different interpretation for the story, for spreading. Because I'm not trying to make light of this. I mean, these anecdotes shed light on the problem of taking any kind of incident of any important person at any epoch in history and showing why the Gemara says Ein Lemeidin Min Hamaaser. Okay, now we get to the racier stuff. This is a hadith. Muhammad said, a woman, I quote, a woman cannot fulfill her obligation to God until she fulfills her obligations to her husband. And if he asks her for, you fill in a three-letter word, while she is on a camel's back, that's one girsa. The other girsa is, while she is on the birthing stool, she cannot deny him his pleasure. Another hadith. Muhammad said, no human may prostrate to another. But if it were permissible for a human to prostrate to another, I would have ordered a wife to prostrate to her husband because of the enormity of his rights over her. By God, please forgive me for this one, if there is an ulcer excreting pus from his feet to the top of his head, and she licked it for him, she would not in this fulfill his rights. Okay? It's not pretty to listen to in the first place. Now, what legal conclusions do you come up with from a hadith like that? So this one, we're not going to be able to blame on the Saudis. It goes back to the 13th century. Ibn al-Jazi, I quote, it is incumbent upon a woman. Now, this is not a new opinion. This is based on this hadith. This is what we learn from this hadith. It is incumbent upon a woman to know that it is as if she is owned by her husband. Therefore, she may not act upon her own affairs or her husband's money except with his permission. She must prefer his rights over her own and over the rights of her relatives and must be ready to let him enjoy her through all clean means. She must not brag about her beauty, must not taunt him about his shortcomings. It is incumbent upon a woman to endure her husband's mistreatment as a slave should. We could spend a good hour just showing how halacha is different from this. How some of the fattest mesechtas in Shas talk about rights women have. Not only their personal rights, but even monetary rights. About how if you had the guy with the ulcer from head to toe, what would the answer be in halacha? Be grounds for divorce. Because he would be legitimately repulsive. How a man decidedly does not have rights for his pleasure anytime he wants,
But Chazal circumscribed them and turned them around into a program of husbands' dutiful attention to women's rights in that matter. And what about pointing out her husband's shortcomings? Remember the Gemara in Brachas about Ashes of Chananya ben Tradyon? Chananya ben Tradyon was one of the Asara Harugi Malchus, one of the 10 martyrs. And the Gemara asks why his wife wound up also in a very tragic fate. And the Gemara says because she recognized her husband's fault. And it wasn't a fault. It was like a halacha that only applied to him and didn't apply to other people because he was an Adam Gadol. But she should have known that he had to act on a different madrig. And by not telling him, she became responsible. The Gemara's depiction of the proper wife is not one who's a milquetoast and sits by without telling her husband his faults, but it's her chiyuv to tell him his fault. And boy, you know, they've done a good job with that. One more. There is something in the Sunnah about how you're supposed to eat. There's a reference to eating with three fingers. Now, why should you eat with three fingers? Because you left your fork and knife at home. That's one explanation. They didn't have forks and knives. Why eat with three fingers? So I called a colleague at the Islamic Center in Los Angeles who is pretty frum, but knows Islamic law pretty well. He came up with a perfectly reasonable explanation. He says it's a musr thing when people did not have cutlery. To eat with two fingers is very inefficient and very slow, but to eat with your whole hand is gluttonous. Is he grabbing too much? See, even though most people would eat with four fingers or five fingers, the refinement was to eat with three fingers. Good. So what happens after you invent forks and knives? So you eat with forks and knives, right? That's what he said. But if you go to ask the imam, like ask the rabbi sites, you will find a prominent site today, that comes from a Salafi source. Salafis are the guys who are going back to the original Islam. Read the text and the Sunnah and the Hadith and make up your mind for yourself. They trash tradition. Actually, not all the Salafis do. Some of them try to modernize it. But it's a fundamentalist movement. The whole Wahhabis in the popular mind are the same thing. This is a wave of Islam that has come over the world. We hope that it's subsiding, but there are a lot of them out there. The Salafis tell you, to a straight question, how are you supposed to eat? You're supposed to eat with three fingers. Ad hayom hazeh. Why? Because we don't intellectualize. Because if it says it, then our role is not to question why, but just to submit and to do. Now, You're all coffee deprived because those of you, I'm sure most people here, have learned Daf Yomi, and not so long ago you came across the Gemara in the Darim, which said that Rav Huna ate porridge with three fingers. Got the same thing. And he said one finger is sweet, two is better, three is better yet. Stops at three. How many people do you know who eat porridge? Actually, better not tell me this. How many major or minor league poskim do you know, have ever seen, who've encouraged people to eat with their fingers because Rav ate with three fingers? They assume that there's another pshat. Indeed, Rabbeinu Bachya says that for certain foods, touch is part of the experience. I don't know if this is going to work with a Canadian audience, but I can tell you, if you go to a baseball game and you're fortunate to go to one of those stadiums where they sell kosher hot dogs, I don't care how much of a yekka you are, you don't want to come You don't want to come to a Toronto Blue Jays game with a fork and knife cutting your friend. It's not going to work. It's not the same thing. There's some things you just got to hold in your hand, like a good half pounder, you know, like oozing. You just can't eat it with a fork and knife. That's all that Rav meant. But when something appears to the incredulous, it doesn't become halacha just because it appears as an anecdote. Let me get to the real question. There was so much in common, much that I couldn't comment upon. When you take a look at early periods of Islam and some of the protocols they had for answering questions and what to do when there is dispute and deciding between different sources, there is so much that either they developed on their own, which is possible, or they borrowed from the Jews around them, which is also possible, and I have no idea which is true. How could they come to such different results in the end, over hundreds and hundreds of years of history? And the answer, I think, is that when push comes to shove, and bear with me, this is subtle, when push comes to shove, there's a difference. The bottom line is there's a difference in the bottom line. The bottom line for Muslims is Quran plus stories. The bottom line for us is our analog, Chumash, plus a redacted form, a written form of Torah Sheba'al Peh in the form of a tightly reasoned legal work. Both have a holy work and something else. The something else for Islam is stories. Stories are infinitely malleable and plastic. A written text, the redaction of Mishnah and Gemara, is not infinitely malleable. Rabbi Lau last night quoted Robert Frost. I will also quote Robert Frost. Home is where they can't send you away. Home in Jewish law is the redaction of Torah Sheba'al Peh. It's Mishnah and Gemara. And no matter how extreme behavior can become at certain times, I'm trying to use up the clock so you don't ask me all the embarrassing questions, but the answer to them would be that it can happen for a while, it can happen in a community. In the end, what triumphs? The understanding of the text itself. You cannot make the text say something that it didn't for too long. You can convince people that it's a necessary chumrah, that we have to do it in the community. Eventually, another counterforce chips away at it and brings things back to what the halacha is. That's the general view. But there are many little pieces of Torah Sheba'al Peh that contribute to this that Muslims didn't have because they didn't have this text-based system that spelled out all of these things as unchangeable. One, halacha in our system is determined by the many or the few. And the answer is always the many, with possibly the exception of Yemenites and following the Rambam. The rest of us never follow a Tana, an Amora, a Rishon consistently. Halacha is the work of the majority, of the many, of people horizontally in one direction and vertically through many generations, poring over an idea. And it's the majority reading that is the one that prevails. Two, in halacha, the laity is involved. We pushed, v'higisa bo yomam v'layla, everybody's supposed to learn Torah. You think that's something that you take for granted? Other religions didn't. Remember, in the Catholic Church, it was forbidden on pain of death. People were executed for reading the Bible to the public. because they didn't want the interpretation of the Bible to get away from the experts. The people making the law in Islamic circles were great jurists. The Hamonam followed. We involve people in the process of legal thinking from childhood. It's amazing. I know of no parallel in any Western legal system. We don't do legal education of our children in elementary school or in high school. And that's maybe why we have such a dim view of the law. We approach the law as consumers. We want the result. When the attorney won't give it to us, the law is terrible. From people, observant people, encounter the law from childhood, asking legal questions. Watch the debate between such legal experts as a mother and her six-year-old child at the checkout counter in a supermarket when the child spots a candy bar. And the mother has to say, well, that's not kosher. So the child finds another one with a kosher symbol. You got the COR, spots the candy bar. And then what happens next? It's chocolate, it's peanuts, and the child asks, so mommy, so which bracha do I make? I make the Adama first, make the Shahako first. One bracha, two brachas. Everybody's involved in the process. You can't hijack the system like Islamic law got hijacked in the last couple of decades when Saudi money literally bought out virtually every Islamic court and every madrasa around the world and imposed the worst kind of Islam, Wahhabism. We are definition. We are definition bound in halacha from day one. Exercise. Forgive me for this one also. Why don't Jews celebrate Christmas? Why don't we celebrate Christmas?
I know why.
Why?
We're all Jews.
We're all Jewish, so why should we celebrate Christmas?
Because we have Hanukkah.
Wrong answer. I'll tell you why we don't celebrate Christmas. Because if Jews would celebrate Christmas, there would have to be a tractate in the Gemara which would tell you how tall your Christmas tree is, how many branches it has, how green the leaves are, how many ornaments you have to put on every branch, and whether you can fulfill the mitzvah by borrowing one from your Catholic neighbor. Because we don't have such a tractate, we don't celebrate Christmas. Okay? What's the idea if Chassid Shalom we did, there were such a thing, there would be such a tractate. Because the important things in activity were subjected to legal inquiry and encoded and redacted in a binding legal text at an early stage, which is where we come up, where we come back to. I mentioned before Ein Lemeidin Min Hamasa. I hope by now you have a clearer understanding of how important this is, that we don't look to stories as the important source of law, or even an important source of law. You're being too kind. You should yell, but how many incidents are there in the Gemara? The Gemara says, we saw Rav doing this, we saw Abaye doing that. But what happens immediately after every one of them? The Gemara says, well, you can't learn A from that. Maybe B was the reason, or maybe C, or maybe D. And only when the Gemara satisfies itself that the only reason that does explain, that fits in with other legal evidence, is A given any credence? And it's usually only to support a previously stated legal opinion, rather than a new source of law. We have protocols for what happens when there are conflicts between laws. We have hierarchies. You will recall perhaps an incident in Saudi Arabia, modern Saudi Arabia, just a few years ago. The Saudis tried covering it up and denying it, but they couldn't because it turned out that there was evidence for it, and you can easily find it today on the web. A girls' high school, a girls' madrasa, started burning. And the girls came running out. What happened next?
Forced back in.
Wrong! That's not what happened next. You skipped a step.
Yeah, they weren't dressed properly.
They weren't dressed properly, and the people around helped the girls. They did. Let's not make it worse than it was. The people around helped the girls, and then what you said happened. Then the Sneas Patrol came by. the whatever it's called, the Committee to Enforce Public Modesty, happened to chance by in a van. They got out of the van, saw what was happening. The girls were not, they weren't wearing the veil. Their faces weren't covered. So they pushed them back into the building. And they died. Why can't that happen? I hope it can't. What's the reason why? What does the Gemara say about a person who sees a woman drowning? Chasid Shota. He doesn't want to jump in because, you know, she's not dressed properly and he's going to have to embrace her and, you know, like, so, and he knows he will. He's not going to react with a reaction that shows Kedusha. He will, as Bill Clinton once said, lust after her in his heart. Jimmy Carter. What does the Gemara call such a guy? Chasid Shota. Chasid Shota, because we have a hierarchy. Sure, it's important. We don't take things like that lightly. Sure, you should be pure in your heart. Sure, your huri avera is terrible. But human life is more important. They tell a story about a
guy who's been a bachelor for too long. Right? So his mother has wanted for years and years and years to see some nachas, to see him married. So one day he calls his mom. It finally happened. I met the woman of my dreams. I want you to come over and meet her. But mom, I'm just so confident about my choice. I'm sure you're going to love her. That at my apartment, I'm going to have three women waiting. And I want you to pick out the one. I want you to identify. So she comes in. There's a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead. She looks them over. Takes about 2 seconds. Points to the brunette. And says, that's the one. Mom, that's great. How did you know? I don't like her already. So, what happens in halacha? And it happens. It happens plenty. It happens plenty. When parents say, her? Him? You want us to have a coronary? You can do whatever you want. You're a grown adult. But, you know, you'll have to decide whether the wedding will be before the funeral or after the funeral. But I'm not going to tell you what to do. Or they just say, no, you can't. I'm your parent and I'm telling you no. Don't you remember the fifth commandment? It's right there in the Bible. Did they teach you anything? So what's the halacha? Encoded in Shulchan Aruch. You don't listen to the parent. Because there are limits placed on even as global and important the mitzvah as Kibud Av V'Em. They're there in the Gemara, and the Marik took that his understanding of the Gemara and translated it into a formalized response to whether you have to listen to the request of a parent about who you're going to marry. Okay. I'm going to stop short to take a few questions. Thank you. So we got 5 minutes of questions. I'll say just by way of concluding. Again, the bottom line of this is that the difference between Islamic law and Jewish law, for all the permutations on the law in the course of history and all of the vicissitudes of time and what they visited upon both systems, in the end, we wound up with something different because of, I hate to put it in these terms, many of the things we all kvetch about in halacha. How come two people ask the rabbi the same question and they get different answers? And how come it's so complicated? And how come we have to learn this Gemara about a rabbinic law in the first place and it has so many complications? Ribbono d'olam kula. If you didn't have all of those picayune details, if you didn't have all that analysis, what you would have is the sordid response to why women can't drive cars. You know why women can't drive cars? Because if women drive cars, they can be out in the open more often, and there'll be more aveira, and we have a rule in Islamic law called blocking the means. Now we also block the means. They're called gezeiros, they're called fences around the law, but you find a gezeira in the Gemara that doesn't have five exceptions to the rule, all thought out and imprinted upon the Gemara at the earliest stages, which means that you then cannot wreak havoc with the system. A physician goes into his garage and comes back a couple of days later. The mechanic says,
It's going to cost us $1,000. Why $1,000? Says it was a really tough problem. I had to do a valve job. And you know something, Doc? He says, I don't know why you're complaining so much. You know, the truth is we both do the same kind of work. And you complain when it costs $1,000? I take out the engine of the car, which is the heart of the car. I repair the valves, put in new ones, give it back to you. It's only $1,000. If I would try that in a local hospital, it would cost me $35,000. What's the difference between you and me? So the mechanic says, yeah, I understand the analogy, but try doing that to the car while it's still running. Halacha has been, Baruch Hashem, the heart, the engine that has kept us going, never stopping, never missing a beat. And it's the intricacies of halacha. It's all that detail that was established in the system that provides the safety that we should not become and cannot become something very, very, very different. Okay, any questions? Thank you. Yes.
I enjoy your talk very much, but very frustrating because in a way you haven't answered why Islam evolved in that direction. It seems to me that they went through the same thing that Judaism went through, which is Dukin and the Prussian, and the Pharisees won out for whatever reason. One reason to be historical that we're spread out, the Galut, etc. There's no central authority, and perhaps Islam had a central authority, and that's why
they
didn't.
Islam was decidedly not centralized. I can't tell you that. I'll switch hats. I'll become rabbi again instead of law professor. I write it off to Hashgacha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew what he was doing, designed a system that would work. Islam had to wrestle with the same problems, often came up with things that were very similar. As I said, either because they imitated or because they did it independently. But they didn't have the same anchoring of the same view of Torah Shabbat Peh the way we do.
But what happened with, what do you call it, the Ishtahad?
Ishtahad.
There was all of a sudden stopped after 200 or 300 years.
Lahavdil.
It seemed to be in the same force.
Right. What happened to our philosophical tradition after Geirus Sfarad? There was a reaction to it. And people attributed what happened in 1492 to over-intellectualizing and too much Maimonidean rationalism. So it got pushed into the background for a while, for a long while. That is what happened to Ishtahad. People said that we're not submitting enough to God. We're over-reliant upon human reasoning. We're not gods, and we have to push in the other direction. That's the best I can do. Yes, ma'am.
Did you touch on the Sharia issues?
I touched upon it. Yeah. But, so there's a wealth of material on Sharia finance. Even Wikipedia has a long entry on it. Yes?
Two brief questions. In Raphael Fatai's books, you wrote on the Arab mind, Jewish mind, and the deceit of Abraham. My summary is that from what he said, Muhammad was an illiterate Arab who had other people write things for him. As you say, he followed a lot of his Jewish neighbors and friends, and they didn't follow him. So, but he also emphasized that he was really a nomad who, if his brother offended him, he would kill him. Now, they regress to pre-Abrahamic times where they go sacrifice their children in suicide. Well, this comment on it. Secondly, a Coptic Christian professional here who had to leave Egypt, but they allowed him to train as a pharmacist, was telling me that according to Islamic law, referring to Obama, if his father was a Muslim, therefore he is a Muslim, and he cannot give that up, and if he converts to another religion, then there should be a fatwa on him, and he should be killed.
There are Muslims who deny that and maintain that that's only true of a Muslim who embraces Islam as an adult, which he never did. I can't tell you what the real reading is or what the Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox Muslims in Egypt today. I expect you're right, and somebody will issue such a fatwa, even though it may not be the regnant ruling. I do want to emphasize, folks, though, that I hope I'm not being too optimistic. I'm usually a litmus cynic. But when you study Islamic law, you see that there is, even the Derech HaTeva, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created possibly one route for the Yeshua, that they don't have to give up Islamic practice or Islamic traditionalism, or they don't have to all become fry in order to be true to their faith and come up with something far more moderate. It makes a huge nafkamina to our community. Do we try to encourage moderate Muslims? And there are lots of them. There are lots of them right here in Canada. Do we try to find those people who either quietly alone are part of that or are waging a struggle to reclaim an older Islam, not create a new one? And if you're just going back to the old one, it's like the old story about, you know, the notch we have in our lip, Rav Soloveitchik's take on that was, what that means is that when we learn Torah, we're not learning anything new. We had it once. It's much easier to learn something that you had once. I mean, lahavdil, Muslims can go back to something they had, not have to ditch the old and invent the new. Yes. The answer to the first one, I don't know. My understanding is that that's not quite true, that they're pretty firm about that, that they don't allow any kind. Maybe they can charge to demons and to pagans, but they don't seem to want it. I don't think they're allowed to accept from anyone, and corporations don't make any difference. So they have had to come up with different bank products. But I can't say that with any confidence. The second one is also only conjecture. But when you have a smaller number of commandments in the first place, it's easier to become very frum about that. There seems to be no question that they are very much into tahara, into not only immersion, but washing before all kinds of things. You walk into any mosque and there's a place to wash your hands, to wash your feet, not just the Kohanim, everybody's doing it. So they were into that. But it's easier to be machmir when you don't have 613 to worry about, but only, you know, your basic five. Yes. So every year, I don't know if it was true in recent years, but I used to see every year American papers, at least in the cities that I grew up, like around December 31st, had a list of laws that were still on the books in various communities and jurisdictions that were all really quirky, but remained on the books. Why? Because no legislature had ever undone them. They were selectively not practiced, but they could be enforced if anybody was, you know, politically incorrect enough to try to do it. Why is this so? Because any legal system worth its salt has something called a due process for changing law. You cannot allow laws to fall out of legality simply because people think, and because everybody may agree, that they don't apply. We're not unique in that. But for many halachas that you could point to, the reason why we still practice things is because the Gemara says, "Kol davar mishab minyan tzarich minyan nachal ha'atira." If it's made by a bona fide body of law, it requires another such body. And a quirk of Golus is that we don't have such a body. We just don't. There's no group, no Bezdin around that enjoys the loyalty of everybody in Judaism. Practices like meat and fish, you're going to find three different opinions. Some will say, well, we think we don't know, but maybe we do. Others will say that, yeah, we've determined that it doesn't, then we'll eat it. And, you know, both of those have a certain amount of validity. When you talk about a real bona fide Issur d'Rabbanan, though, even if everybody agreed that it would no longer apply, it has to stay on the books until another Bezdin can revoke it. However, Maratz Chiyus in Taras, I forgot which Sefer, proves from the Gemara that in those circumstances, when a halacha really doesn't apply anymore, and it also goes out of practice, that Bezdin should not look to reinvent it and to bring it back into practice. So I can't deliver entirely, but it is basically just a matter of good legal principle. I think we better call it here before our lunch gets cold. Thank you very much.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.